Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up in a few minutes, Kristen Espelon talks with a founding member of the group Hotter Times. They're changing the way Louisvillians look at landscaping. First, skyrocketing unemployment has Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear and top education officials searching for ways to help the jobless pursue new skills and new careers. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh says tuition breaks is one idea getting a positive response.
Unemployment rates in Kentucky are climbing, with at least 17 counties now reporting jobless rates exceeding 13%. The state is experiencing extended shutdowns at manufacturing plants, combined with numerous layoffs and plant closings. Kentucky's unemployment insurance fund has dropped from more than $200 million to zero, and now relies on borrowed money from the federal government. But Governor Beshear says the statistics only hint at the misery.
Behind every impersonal number is the face of a family in crisis. As governor, I see these faces as I travel around the state. They're lined with worry, with frustration, and with outright fear.
Beshear says the state is doing everything it can to help by providing families with short-term unemployment benefits and other forms of assistance. But he says long-term assistance is needed. That's why he's getting behind a career transitions program now being offered at community and technical colleges across the Commonwealth.
This program will help Kentucky reshape its economy by meeting the projected demand for workers in key areas. It's designed to provide Kentuckians who have lost their jobs with workforce training in high-growth, high-wage fields.
Kentucky Community and Technical College President Michael McCall says the two-year colleges are perfectly positioned to offer such a program.
It's a year-long initiative that's being offered at all 16 of our colleges, the 67 campuses, and it features a 50% tuition scholarship for up to 6 credit hours per term, spring, summer, and fall, in open enrollment courses, along with personalized assistance to help navigate throughout the college admissions process.
McCall says colleges will also provide advisors and training sessions that will maximize a student's chances of success in re-employment. He says unemployed Kentucky residents who have filed for unemployment benefits since October 1, 2008 are eligible for the program.
The achievement here is simply to get them started into college, and so the piece that they have to do, of course, is meet all the admissions requirement, and we'll do a tuition waiver for these students, a scholarship for them.
McCall says the career transition program could save some students more than $1,000 a year, depending on how many courses they take per semester. Roger Thompson of KDIS is already in the program and has no complaints.
I'm thoroughly impressed with it. Yes, I am.
Thompson worked for automotive supplier Johnson Controls in Trigg County for almost 14 years before being laid off last year. He's now studying electronics at Hopkinsville Community College.
I've been enrolled since January for the spring semester, and it's been working for me. And
Are they giving you the break on tuition?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, they are. They are giving me the break on tuition. Nothing's had to come out of my pocket thus far.
Also taking advantage of the Career Transitions Program is Gary Dixon of Princeton, who also got laid off by Johnson Controls. He encourages other unemployed Kentuckians to give the program a serious look.
Well, I think, you know, if you really want some help, we'll help you out through computer training, some math refresher courses, and anything, any kind of help that you offer, they offer you a lot.
Michael McCall says it's too early to put a price tag on the program, but if enough Kentuckians take advantage of it, he says he will work hard to make sure it's continued in future years. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
Hotter Times is a new landscaping collective in Louisville. Members live and work together, but they're aiming for more than pretty Victorian gardens and trimmed hedgerows. They want to revolutionize the way we care for the land. Whit Forrester is a founding member. He tells Kristen Espelon how he came up with the name Hotter Times.
I got back to Louisville after school, and I've been wanting to do landscaping my entire life. I spent 4 years trying to think maybe I didn't. And got back here and wanted to post something on like the green pages online, you know, and just had to come up with a name and an email on the spot. So, you know, there's a lot of debate and talk about climate change, and we had just come off like a three-month drought at that point. So it seemed like Hotter Times is a good thing to kind of like draw attention to that and also draw attention to the effect that has on the landscape.
And now you are a collective, you say?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how that works exactly.
It's a collective endeavor, basically, and we're still sort of figuring it out, to be entirely honest. There's a lot of different groups around the country that are kind of approaching land care this way as a collective effort. We all operate making less than like $6,000 a year, each one of us. But when you live collectively as well, it's not that much of a big deal. All our rent is pretty low. So essentially all the money gets shared and a lot of the jobs get thrown out to the collective, and people with different skills can say, oh, that person wants, you know, this deck to be built that way. I can do that. I do a lot of pre-colonial landscaping stuff, so I take care of most of the design work in yards. Other folks do a lot of like permacultural water installations and pond work and that kind of thing.
Pre-colonial landscaping? Tell me what that means.
If you look at a lot of the terminology surrounding landscaping, you've got like invasive, exotic, colony forming, you know, native, these kinds of words that are rooted in a lot of like colonial standards, and that don't address a lot of like the social implications of using these words. So when you're doing landscaping and you're trying to do some kind of social justice thing too, when you switch up terms like pre-colonial, then you have an opportunity to have a conversation. And I really enjoy having conversations surrounding colonization and tying together like, you know, global climate change and Western standards for beauty, especially in terms of lawn, by using terms like pre-colonial.
It leads me to think of native plants and grasses and things like that.
That's essentially what they are. It's a substitute term that is basically an avenue by which we can have larger conversations.
I want to get into some specifics in terms of what you're thinking along the lines of landscaping, appropriate plants, appropriate water use when it comes to climate change. So in your estimation, what do you think over the next, I don't know, 10 to 20 years will grow really well here, maybe that didn't grow so well before?
Well, in the past 10 years, we've gone from a 6B agricultural zone to like a 7A. So that basically means on average, we're about 5 degrees warmer than we used to be. A's and B's are, you know, 5 degrees. So I guess in the term of like 10 to 20 years, if things keep on escalating as they are, and things are exponentially escalating on top of that, the droughts that we've seen for the past couple of years could end up being way more severe, longer lasting, less rain. So in terms of stuff that grows well here, it's really hard to say, but it's definitely going to be things that do better with less water and much more intense climates and less winter time.
Are you also thinking about it changing the way you design a landscape, the
Absolutely.
Way you design a garden?
Absolutely. A lot of the impetus behind redesigning these sorts of things comes from looking at the way that people interact across their landscape. So what happens when a neighborhood decides that they don't want fences anymore? So you go from having maybe a 10 by 30 foot plot of land to a commons. It also instigates more interactions with your neighbors, encourages people to really just be friendlier to one another and to think more cooperatively, which in my opinion is kind of what the next 10 to 50 to 500 years is going to be about, is going back to these ideas of cooperation and, you know, learning from each other.
Have you actually had an experience where you've designed a landscape for a neighborhood or a group like that, taking out fences? And what does that mean for the plant life?
Only in my mind. What does it mean for the plant life? Well, plants do a lot better when they have fungal relationships. And fungus does better when it has a large ecology-type community to deal with. So what that would mean for designing a landscape, especially in terms of permaculture and such, is that you would have healthier soil, and you'd have more productive plants. You'd probably have better water-saving schemes. If you're growing agricultural produce, you'd have more in general. And also being able to have less fragmented, I guess from like an ecological point of view, less fragmented habitats and ecosystems is also better for wildlife as well. It's one of the large problems we're looking at with biodiversity loss right now is the way that like neighborhoods come in and you get all these parcels of stuff instead of continuous habitats.
Absolutely. Tell me a little bit about what you anticipate in terms of water use. You mentioned, you know, we'd come out of a drought. By some accounts, we're still in that drought, and they're going to get more intense and more frequent.
I mean, Lexington had water rationing a couple summers ago, and Louisville's sort of lucky because we're next to the Ohio, which is the watershed for this vast region. So we're set up better than more inland areas are. But in terms of water use for the next couple of years, it's pretty bleak. There's a lot of water privatization going on. It's seen as kind of the next currency in some ways. If you have water, you have power, which is scary. I see people needing to have to start going towards gray water systems. So gray water is basically what comes out of your sink and your laundry. And a lot of it, you can use biodegradable soaps, phosphate-free, that kind of thing. And from a permacultural standpoint, it's a total resource. It's an amazing resource.
And permaculture, can you just define that for me?
Comes from permanent agriculture. It's the idea of designing things that are agriculturally productive, that are whole systems. So I guess what that means is basically designing, for instance, maybe like an herb spiral or something like that. So you would take what would be a 30-foot line, you wrap it around itself and make it vertical, and it becomes like a 5 or 6 foot spiral that spirals down. And you can water that, let's say, with gray water from your house that ends up in a koi pond at the bottom.
That sounds like a very urban-friendly way to garden as well.
And that brings up another thing that I've been wanting to do with this whole landscaping thing, is that urban-friendly stuff needs to also take into account that urban soils are trashed, loaded with lead and all kinds of stuff. We're lucky enough that a lot of like fungus and plants have the ability to break down stuff like PCBs even, or hyperaccumulate lead. So I think that, we're not really at that point of knowing exactly how to implement those strategies, especially on a community-based level, but I keep hoping that this landscaping collective will end up having some component of, community-based research that can do that kind of research and looking at, parts per million absorption of sunflowers and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The things you've talked about, using the resource of gray water, planting native plants that are, adapted to mm-hmm. needing less water, these kinds of things. To what degree would you say this kind of landscape design is perhaps more sustainable than what we've been doing in the past anyway?
So in terms of not being sustainable, when you have a grass that grew in a temperate climate in England that's living in Kentucky, which is increasingly having droughts for 3 months every year, and we've got water problems and we have social problems associated with, needing to cut off our land and, remove ourselves from interacting with one another, then that is not sustainable. And when we're looking towards a future with, diminished fuel supplies and diminished water supplies and, an increased need for reliance upon your local community, it makes sense to break down those barriers. And it makes sense to start using things that are agriculturally productive and hopefully at the same time pre-colonial.
That was Kristen Espelon speaking with Landscaping Collective founder Whit Forrester. Passion takes many forms, and collecting art is one of them. Throughout history, most collectors have been considerably wealthy. But today, a collector doesn't have to be a Rockefeller. Elizabeth Kramer reports.
In one part of the Speed Art Museum, Chief Curator Ruth Cloudman shows me some paintings in its permanent collection. They're by famed Impressionist artists, including Claude Monet and American Mary Cassatt. Cloudman describes how a wealthy Louisvillian, Minnie Marvin Wheeler, very quietly collected these pieces before her death in 1964.
She would get these things. They would come to the museum for, say, a month on loan anonymously. And then when she passed away, this bequest came, and it was this joyous shock to the community that these treasures had been given to the Speed Museum.
Since then, many local and wealthy collectors have donated works to the museum. But this month, the museum has received 50 pieces from Dorothy and Herbert Vogel of Brooklyn, New York, a couple art aficionados have called the world's most famous living collectors. He's now 85 and she is 73, but before they retired, they lived off her salary as a reference librarian and used his from his job with the United States Postal Service to purchase art. Their collection included minimal and conceptual art that they bought from artists before many attained critical fame. The Vogels kept thousands of pieces in their rent-controlled apartment. Last year, they announced they would donate 2,500 of their works to museums in 50 states through the National Gallery of Art. At the time of her death, Louisville's Minnie Marvin Wheeler was a fairly traditional collector. She was wealthy. But the Vogels' means and approach to collecting marked a sea change in the profile of a collector. So says Suzanne Weaver, the museum's curator of contemporary art.
They spent their whole life going to openings, galleries, and art studios. They lived and breathed art. And they became friends with the dealers. They became friends with the artists. So they really knew the work.
While people of means still collect, many of today's collectors aren't rich.
Today, there are more people on all walks of life and at all socioeconomic levels collecting, which is really exciting.
That's Paige West. She's a curator and founder of a New York gallery. She also wrote The Art of Buying Art, an insider's guide to collecting contemporary art. West says another phenomenon has fed the upsurge in collecting.
The access to art has just exploded. in a way that's created all new audiences and collector groups.
That access is evident in Louisville. The Speed Museum has several collectors groups, and the city has dozens of galleries, from those at the 21C Museum Hotel to those featuring glass and craftwork. One of the city's oldest is Zephyr Gallery. Artist Chris Radke is a member of this artist collective. She says even purchases of a few hundred dollars affect the local visual art scene.
When somebody does buy a piece of work, you have no idea how that resonates in the art community. Because not only does it help the artist will tell another artist that, and it gives everybody huge hope. You know? It's like a validation that what they're doing is valuable, is worth it.
Radke says the recent economic downturn has slowed sales somewhat, but collectors are still buying. She also tells me of one non-traditional collector, Leslie Millar. She's 43 and married to an artist.
And then this is a piece from Stephen Irwin.
In the Highlands neighborhood, Millar gives me a tour of their home. Throughout the house are paintings, photographs, and prints. There are also ceramics and textile-based art. Most are by local artists, including Steve Irwin and Michael O'Bannon. Millar doesn't liken herself to the Vogels, but like the Vogels, she says relationships influence her purchases.
I think often it really is a personal connection, a human connection with the person who made it and their story.
And even in this economic recession, Millar's not giving up her penchant for collecting. She says the economy reinforces her commitment to support local artists through her purchases. And she finds much of the art she sees reminds her of human values like compassion. The Vogels just might agree with her. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
When we come back, Gabe Buller talks with the author of Wikipedia Revolution. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. In 8 years of operation, the free open-source online encyclopedia Wikipedia has become one of the most visited sites on the Internet. Anyone can edit Wikipedia, and the combined knowledge is nearly all-encompassing. For example, there's just as much information on Marge Simpson as there is about Laura Bush. And all of that information is surprisingly accurate, says Andrew Lee. He's the author of the book The Wikipedia Revolution, and he recently talked with Gabe Bullard.
Tell me the basic story of Wikipedia.
Okay, well, the basic story of Wikipedia is that it started out actually as a very conventional project called Newpedia. And while most people now look at Wikipedia as a free online encyclopedia, it had very traditional and conventional roots. And it was started in 2000 as a project of Jimmy Wales and Larry Sanger to create a electronic encyclopedia, but it was restricted to experts editing and contributing to it. And something that they found out after a year of a very rigorous 7-step editing process and tight screening of who could participate and requiring PhDs and higher degrees was that they only had about 24 articles done after, you know, a lot of money spent and 1 year of production. So in January 2001, they decided they try this new technology called Wiki and open up contribution to the encyclopedia to the general public on the Internet. And it just took off from there. And they found lots of people coming online to help edit this encyclopedia. And that's how the whole Wikipedia revolution started.
Something that a lot of people talk about with Wikipedia is they're concerned that because of that, because it is a wiki, that who knows who's editing it and who knows how accurate it is. But it is very accurate, correct?
Right. It's actually one of the famous sayings in Wikipedia is the problem with Wikipedia is that it works in practice but not in theory. So when someone describes to you how it works, your traditional thinking kicks in and says, there's no way that could possibly be accurate, right? Anyone being able to edit any page at any time means that it's going to be complete garbage as content. But when people start looking through the pages of Wikipedia, they realize, wow, this is actually much better than I thought. And not only is it much better, it's more complete, it's more in-depth, it's has a wider range of topics, and there's something interesting going on here. You know, if we don't have in Wikipedia a strict process of how things work in terms of an editing life cycle, and just people pitch in where they can, we need to rethink the entire enterprise of creating work on the internet in a collaborative fashion. And that's basically what the implications of Wikipedia have been on the internet, that people are rethinking the whole idea of crowdsourcing and how to combine the work of distributed people on the internet.
The wiki technology was fairly new when Wikipedia came along, but are there other models of crowdsourcing from around that same time, from around early 2000s, that kind of influenced the current craze?
Yeah, I think Wikipedia followed along the lines of other types of projects that have been able to harness the power and the wisdom of the crowds, as they say. But I think Wikipedia is by far the most free form and the most ambitious of those projects. And the result now is that Wikipedia shows up in usually the top 10 search results in Google anytime you look for anything on the internet. And because of that, it's now in the top 10 most visited websites in the world, you know, right up there with Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, AOL, those types of sites that we're all used to seeing. The difference is those are for-profit sites, and Wikipedia is a nonprofit that has a fairly modest budget, and they've been able to do that through volunteers that kick in their efforts, not only editing encyclopedias, the encyclopedia, but also in terms of helping out on the technical support and donating time to maintain the servers and to upgrade the software.
I haven't checked out some of the other languages that Wikipedia is in, but how do the articles compare in scope and size and number?
Right. Wikipedia actually has versions in over 200 different languages. Certainly not all those languages are as big as English Wikipedia, which is over 2.8 million entries. But the other very successful languages include German, French, Japanese, obviously, Esperanto. As some of you know, Esperanto speakers and followers of that language are very prevalent on the internet. So one of the first languages that got a big boost in Wikipedia was Esperanto, because the speakers of Esperanto and the studiers of Esperanto are distributed across the world, because there's no one country where that language is spoken in a majority. So you have other languages that are quite unusual to be ranked so high, like Swedish is quite high. Chinese, ironically, is quite small because it has been blocked in China for a long time. And so Chinese Wikipedia actually is quite small given the number of native language speakers.
And is the Chinese Wikipedia, is it unblocked in China now?
It is now. It was unblocked completely a little bit before the 2008 Olympics in China. So for up until that point, it had been blocked for almost 2 years straight. It had been blocked, unblocked, off and on before that. But now if you go visit Wikipedia inside China, it's completely unblocked.
Do you think the fact that Wikipedia was blocked by the Chinese government says something about the power of an information source like this?
I think what happened during those years it was blocked, there's two main reasons why sites are blocked in China, and some of the listeners out there might know that I wrote most of this book while living in Beijing, China. I didn't have to live there. I'm writing about an online community, so anywhere with an internet connection was fine, but I just happened to be based there, and there are technologies of getting around these internet blocks in China, which are pretty easy to do. But the main reason why China blocks these sites include, one, obviously sensitive information. So the traditional topics have been things like the Tiananmen Square 1989 incident, or Tibet freedom, or Falun Gong, the religious practice of Falun Gong. The other reason, which most people don't quite recognize, is that it's for a commercial advantage. So by blocking certain sites that are located outside of China, you allow a local commercial competitor to rise and to become popular in China. And that's kind of what happened there, is that you actually have some big internet companies in China that have created their own types of Wikipedia-like products. So now in China, even though Wikipedia is unblocked, you do a search on the search engines in China, and you normally don't come up with the Wikipedia article for those topics in Chinese. Because Wikipedia is blocked for so long, it's not really linked into the internet fabric in China as much as the English language Wikipedia shows up in English language searches.
So to go back to the topic of how Wikipedia works in general, you don't have to be an expert to edit it, but there are some rules of etiquette, correct?
That's right. You don't have to prove you're an expert. They, you know, the mantra inside Wikipedia is that they won't. There's no titles or there's no expert authority that is designated to any person because you have a PhD or that you, or a higher degree. So there are basically rules of behavior and rules of or rules and standards for what kind of information is put into Wikipedia. So the, probably the most important editorial policy in Wikipedia is what they call the neutral point of view, or NPOV. When you have this many people working together on the internet, you have to make sure that it's what they call co-labor and not anti-labor, right? You want to make sure people are working together on something rather than pulling things apart. So the NPOV, or neutral point of view, is the policy that says you must try to treat all sides of a topic fairly. And that is not only to harness the benefit of people working together, but also it's good for the article that you write there. So you cannot just write you know, two or three different versions of an article and keep them in different spaces in Wikipedia. There's only one article about Israel, or only one article about Barack Obama, and you have to all work together on that article. And the NPOV is the thing that binds people together to work towards a common goal.
So there are some editors, though, who look out for this, correct?
Well, it's pretty much a rule that anyone who edits Wikipedia has to adhere by that neutral point of view policy. So some people who are doing simple fact-checking or adding facts to an article normally don't run into this. But when you do have paragraphs that try to explain the significance of a particular person in history, that's where these policies start to become important. So one of them is neutral point of view as a way of writing the articles. There are other things like verifiability or reliable sources. So when you put in a fact or you put in something into an article, you have to make sure there's a reference for it. You know, is there a newspaper article that said that, or is there a history book that proves this thing? So these are the standards that you have in Wikipedia in terms of making sure you reference your sources and that you're writing from a neutral point of view.
I think the power of this, I'll say hive mind, to use a buzzword going around a lot, right. Is an example recently. Stephen Colbert sometimes encourages people to edit Wikipedia on
right.
his show, but it seems like almost instantly it's changed, and then just as instantly it's changed back.
Right. So actually part of the fascinating behavior of the community is that different folks who join Wikipedia take up different types of tasks. As you mentioned before, some might concentrate on spell checking, some might concentrate on writing new articles, but you actually have an entire legion of folks who specialize in combating vandalism and making sure that trolls and vandals don't overrun Wikipedia. That's normally what they call the recent changes patrol, because there's a page on Wikipedia that show all the recent changes that have been made to Wikipedia, and you have people who volunteer to be almost like the street cops of Wikipedia to make sure that vandalism doesn't run rampant on the site.
How many registered Wikipedia users are there?
Well, it's tough to say how many registered actual users there are, because anyone can create an account. But in terms of how many active users there are at any one time, you know, you're talking about every month the number of active editors, at least for English Wikipedia, is in the neighborhood, you know, over 10,000 active editors at any one time, right? Or 10,000 active editors per month. And it depends on what you mean by active, whether that you count anyone who's edited more than once a month, or edited more than 10 times a month, or edited more than 100 times a month. But, you know, the numbers are pretty constant now in terms of getting tens of thousands of people per month who are editing on a regular basis.
I'll ask a little bit about the future of Wikipedia. And once I'd read an article fairly recently, and the concern was from the author that eventually Wikipedia will become the main source for information on the internet. And at that point, when the other sources start to dry up, the project itself will start to suffer. Is that realistic at all?
I don't think that scenario is particularly significant, but I think there is a concern that the way that you use Wikipedia is a very important thing. So people who are trying to explain how Wikipedia works to folks often say it should be the starting point of research, it shouldn't be the ending point of research. Right, so it's a great starting point to understand a topic if you're coming completely cold to a subject. But it should not be taken as the gospel or the reference source that you put into a term paper or anything else. You know? In that sense, it's a great starting point. It gets you up to speed very fast onto a topic, but it should not be the source that you cite in the end. And if you think about it that way, it's exactly how we were taught in high school to use Encyclopedia Britannica or World Book, right? At least when I was in college, we didn't have Wikipedia. We had Encyclopedia Britannica. But the professors would never take Britannica as the source for a paper. So it's no different with Wikipedia, that you use Wikipedia to start your research. It shouldn't be the end of your research.
That was Gabe Bullard talking with Andrew Lee, author of the book The Wikipedia Revolution. There's more information at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, we'll learn more about the upcoming season of the Louisville Orchestra. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up next weekend is Orangutan Awareness Weekend at the Louisville Zoo. We'll learn more about the apes at the zoo and the plight of their species elsewhere in the world. First, the Louisville Orchestra recently announced its season for 2009-2010. It includes a commissioned composition and soloists, among them Joshua Bell. Elizabeth Kramer sat down with George Mester, the orchestra's music director.
How did you choose the music for the Louisville Orchestra's next season?
One of the parameters that I like to think about in choosing the music for the Louisville Orchestra is finding out what they have never played before, because it always creates excitement among the orchestra. And for example, we just finished doing Yolanta. Nobody's ever done that before. So it's, I think, a really energizing idea for the orchestra to be able to play things that are not war horses all the time. And there was the idea that we might show off the virtuosity of the orchestra by doing the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra, the Lutosławski Concerto for Orchestra. And so that helped us kind of get a unified view about what the program should be.
Well, how does the Bartok and the other piece show off the talents of the Louisville Orchestra?
Well, they're called Concerto for Orchestra, so that each of the sections of the orchestra is highlighted in these pieces. You have things that show off the percussion, things that show off the brass, there are individual solos. All in all, it's like having a fantastically powerful portion, all shiny and ready to roar.
And have you heard from audiences about having these new works that they've never heard before, especially in the past several years? What have been the reactions to that?
I think the reaction is gratitude. I think most people, if I kind of apologize and say, I hope this program was not too far out for you, they usually say, no, that's the reason we're coming. So, you know, this orchestra and the community have both a very long history of supporting cutting edge. And I'm not sure we're cutting edge anymore, because everybody's cutting edge these days. But at least we have an orchestra that's excited about the repertoire and the audience that seems to be very early on already responding with a great amount of renewals.
And also, I know that George Santakis's piece is on the program.
We commissioned the piece of George Santakis, and he was a previous Grauemeyer winner.
When was the last time that the Louisville Orchestra had a commissioned piece?
We did a commissioned piece by Peter Schickley, and he wrote this charming piece, which will be repeated this year, based on witticisms and puns that Lincoln liked.
And a lot of people know him as P.D.Q. Bach.
Yes.
Are commissions something that are very common with the Louisville Orchestra?
Well, they used to be extremely common when the commissioning process started back in the early 50s. Then, when I came on board, the financial support for the commissioning had already been exhausted. And so when I became the music director back in 67, my job was to find pieces that had never been recorded before, because the name of the recording series was First Edition Records.
How did commissions play a role in recent years?
You need a tremendous amount of money to pay the fee of the composer and the copying and so on. And I think that the orchestra has gone in different directions. I think the recording project was unique in the time when it was happening. But now you have other record companies that are issuing everything that ever was written. And so it became, the orchestra was no longer in the recording business. There's no market for it now.
But what do commissions mean today? I mean, it's very difficult considering the financial resources that have to be tapped in order to do that. But what does committing those financial resources do for the orchestra?
Well, I think it does a lot for everybody because I think, first of all, a living musician wants to support living composers. And I think it's a very important thing. In the old days, you had the royal courts in Europe supporting composers. And now we have foundations doing exactly the same thing. And there are very inventive types of commissions where several orchestras enter into consortium kind of arrangement in which they all commit to perform the piece that has been commissioned. They share then the costs. There are other sources of funding that stipulate that the particular piece has to be performed X number of times. So there's a great need and I think importance to supporting living music.
The soloists for next season kicks off with Joshua Bell.
Right.
And this is not his first appearance with the orchestra.
No, but it's the first appearance since I've been here. And the last time I saw Joshua Bell, he was 16 at Aspen. And he was raked over the coals for being a bad boy in orchestra. So I think we'll make it up to him.
And what about the other soloists?
Well, Joyce Yang is coming. I did Tchaikovsky Concerto with her, which was spectacular. She's got a very exciting career. She's already played several times with the New York Philharmonic. And after our first performance of the Tchaikovsky Concerto, we went bowling. So there you have a pianist who's not afraid to use her fingers for things other than playing the piano.
How did you choose the soloist to play with the orchestra this season?
Well, Joshua Bell was a no-brainer. He's at IU, and he's a great violinist, and his name recognition is universal. I've always wanted to do this piece with him, the Scottish Fantasy of Bruch. So that gave me the idea of doing a kind of travelogue, because we're starting with Ports of Call. Escal is the official name. It's three pieces in a suite depicting different ports of call. We have Scottish, then we have the Rhine Journey, and then we have Pines of Rome. That gives us a little geographic tour.
Why specifically did you think of this piece for Joshua Bell?
Well, to be honest, that's the only piece he offered. So that gave us the hook to make a program that's really interesting.
It's kind of like setting sail for the season.
Yes,
setting
off in a way, we're off on a journey of discovery.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
The orangutan population on the planet is dwindling. The Louisville Zoo will host an orangutan awareness weekend next weekend to show off its four orangutans and educate the public about the challenges facing the orangutan population in the wild. Stephanie Sanders spoke with the supervisor of animal training at the zoo, Jane Ann Franklin.
What should I know about orangutans that I don't know?
Well, one of the things you should know is that orangutans share 97% of the same genetic material that you and I have. They're one of our closest living relatives.
Okay, so what does that mean?
That means that they grow a lot like we do, they mature a lot like we do, they think a lot like we do, they problem solve, they can manipulate their environment. When we're working with them and training them, they a lot of times train us just as hard as we try to train them.
How do you mean? Give me some examples.
Like manipulating things. Like redirecting our attention to something else that's maybe cuter or gets better reaction.
Sure. Do you have a story?
Amber does. She's pretty compliant most of the time. Every now and then she really does like, you know, she wants, you'll ask her for something and maybe she doesn't particularly want to do that, but she'll make a goofy face at you and make you laugh.
Mm-hmm.
So she totally throws you off guard.
And she knows she's doing that.
Oh, yeah. And she works the public regularly. With people show up to the exhibit, and she'll knock on the glass, and she'll point at women's purses in particular. And then the people show her their purse, and then she knocks. And without verbal communication, they understand innately that she wants them to open that person. They start taking things out of it.
Wow.
And if they stop, she'll look at them and knock on the glass again and point, like, I didn't tell you could stop.
Nice.
And they'll continue to bring things out.
Well, that would just be dangerous if she was just walking around the street. She could
get people to empty their purses.
She'd
have people giving her all kinds of stuff.
So what kinds of things are you, you mentioned training. I mean, what are you training them?
We train our orangutans so we can take better care of them. Through our training, they let us in, so to speak, and we can get up close and personal. It's through protected contact. We don't ever go in with them. But they present their hands, their feet, their eyes, their mouths. We can clean their teeth through training and polish them just like you use a Cavitron and a polisher just like at the dentist's office, collect blood from them voluntarily, x-ray them. And because we have such a close working relationship that is based on trust, because you do not want to teach them how to deceive you, because they will practice their deception themselves.
And that can get dangerous, I imagine.
It could be. Because of that level of trust, we can vaccinate them. They get a flu shot every flu season, just like we do, and it's no big deal. It's no big deal.
Sure. So why, the reason we're talking is because there's going to be an orangutan awareness weekend at the zoo. I guess, why is there a need for an event like that?
One of the reasons why is because orangutans are disappearing at an alarming rate. It is projected that within the next 10 years, it's possible orangutans won't exist in the wild.
And where do they exist in the wild?
They exist on the islands of Sumatra and Borneo.
Okay, that doesn't seem like very many places.
Pardon me?
So that doesn't seem like very many places.
No.
Did they used to be in more places than that?
Yes, they used to. At one point in time, they ranged up into the mainland of Southeast Asia and in China. But
okay,
they've been pretty much isolated to these two islands.
What happens to them? Are people killing them?
It's a combination of things. The biggest thing is habitat loss, which can be the logging of the old growth forests for its timber, and also the destruction of the forest to plant palm oil plantations. And palm oil is replacing a lot of our vegetable oils because there's no trans fat in it. But these palm oil trees, they can only produce so many years, and then they're kind of useless. And so these big areas of jungle that are being cut down are isolating pockets of orangutans and not leaving their treetop highway open to them to be able to travel the far ways that they would travel in the wild. And orangutans are very different than most other apes in the fact that they're solitary.
Hmm.
They're the only true arboreal ape. And they range typically 80 to 100 feet up in the canopy, and they don't have to come down.
Wow.
They live up there.
That's cool.
You know, it's like 10 stories.
Yeah.
And so they have highways through the jungle, and when these old growth forests get cut down, their pathways are interrupted.
Mm.
And so they end up living in these isolated pockets. Not only that, but when they get isolated like that, they can't get to some of the trees that fruit on a schedule. Some trees fruit annually, some trees fruit biannually, and they need to teach their offspring where those trees are so that they know what time of the year and what year to go to those trees. But when they're isolated from those, then they start coming down and they start getting into the palm oil plantations, and that causes a problem. And that's where folks will kill them. They will, as they're logging and they're taking the trees down, they may find a female that's in an isolated tree. If she has an offspring, they may kill her and take her baby and sell her baby to the pet trade. For every five baby orangutans that go to the pet trade, four of them will die.
Sure. Well,
one will make it.
Sure. I imagine there are, you know, so you're raising awareness about it next weekend at the zoo.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine, are there organizations that you guys are kind of pointing people to that are working to help orangutans?
Yes. They're intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Orangutan Conservancy, and that's who we're going to donate our money to. And then they will pick projects that are on the ground going now that our money will be. They'll be able to buy them supplies, whether it be medical supplies for some of the rehabilitation centers or tools or things like that. rehabilitate those little babies.
Sure. Can you give me a little quick bio? I understand there are four orangutans at the Louisville Zoo.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell me a little bit about each of them?
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you a lot about each of them.
All right.
We have a pair of Sumatran orangutans. There are two different subspecies. We have a pair of Sumatran orangutans. Bella is 24. She is our oldest orangutan, and she is quite about herself. We do have a recommendation for her to have an offspring, so we are waiting for she and Segundo, our male Sumatran orangutan, who's 21 years old, to decide that they should get together.
What do you mean you have a recommendation for her to have an offspring?
Orangutans are, we participate in the SSP, which is the Species Survival Plan, and that's through AZA, the American Zoo and Aquarium Association of Zoos and Aquariums.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do, I sit on the steering committee for orangutans, and what we do is we have a genetic bank of where all the orangutans in North America came from and who's related to who and who is, you know, how closely kin they are to one another. And we try to maximize genetic diversity in our mm-hmm. population. So we look at relatedness coefficients and mean kinship values, and we make recommendations on animals that should be put together.
I see. So you guys are just letting Bella and Segundo hang out a lot.
Yes.
I see.
Well, and you have to understand, she at one point in time was with a male,
mm-hmm.
and she had part of one of her fingers was bitten off, and that's not uncommon for apes. They're incredibly powerful animals, you know, 6 to 8 times as strong as a human.
Mm-hmm.
And so she didn't have the greatest start with males.
Sure.
So she, when
Can't
she
blame the girl.
Segundo, she was really, really tough on him, and he was a lot younger.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's pretty laid back about the whole deal. He's kind of like, I'm going to wait for her to buy me a drink. I'm not buying her one at a time.
All right. What other orangutans do we have here?
We have Teak and Amber, who are, they're considered hybrids. They're half Bornean and half Sumatran. They're 21 years old as well, and they're half brother and sister. They had the same dad.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been together since they were about a month old. They were hand-raised. They were born at the Como Zoo and hand-raised at the Columbus Zoo. And they were I call them our starter set of orangutans.
Hmm.
They were the first pair to come to the Louisville Zoo.
Oh, I see. So you had mentioned, I can't remember, I think it was Bella you were talking about earlier, who's kind of a jokester and getting people to take stuff out of their
Amber,
purses.
Yeah.
Oh, Amber. Okay. So I guess, are they usually like, is it Amber who's mostly like that, or are there a lot of antics going on with the orangutans?
They all have a really interesting sense of humor, not to anthropomorphize them, but the boys tend to be more laid back and say, you know, whatever it is I need to do to get my food, that's cool. They like to participate. They like to hang out with you. They're just quieter.
Sure.
The females tend to be more extrovert-like. They like to manipulate anybody that's in the building, and they really like it when new people come in because everybody's like, wow, did you see what she did? You know?
So they like to show off.
Oh, yeah. and they figure at some point in time, a lot of times whenever they do new things, they get reinforced for it because we have a part of our training sessions where we ask them to do something new.
Mm, I see.
And we allow them, you know, they're creative, and they get reinforced for novel behavior.
Nice.
Yeah, and it's very fun because they become very expressive, and they are really funny, and they've learned, you know, when we smile and laugh, that's the goal of that.
Hmm.
And then they get a favorite fruit item, or they get all their fruit, or they get juice, or they get something that they really want.
That was Jane Ann Franklin, the supervisor of animal training at the Louisville Zoo, speaking with Stephanie Sanders. The zoo will host an Orangutan Awareness Weekend next weekend. There's more information at our website, wfpl.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at wfpl.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Hallett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.